Okay, good morning.
Good morning.
We got the survivors assembled here. Well, Sunday morning's when you find out who's really serious, you know, or really sick, I don't know which. I'd like to start out with a little short meditation. The backstory on this was that a few years back I was selected to be the sacrificial alcoholic at our state Al-Anon convention, and by the way, if you've never been to an Al-Anon convention, it's a blast. I mean, I went a whole weekend with about 800 people, not one cell phone went off in the room. Nobody got up for coffee during the meeting. Everybody was in their chair, and there was as many people on Friday night as Saturday night and Sunday morning. I mean, I've never seen discipline like that. It was fabulous.
Non-drug. You have discipline to be in our lives.
So anyway, but they gave me a very nice room, but I had a lot of alone time there, and so I ended up kind of drifting into this thing. So what if this night that I'm spending here in this room, what if this time right now was it? This is it. And so I went into meditation, and I just called it the last 100 breaths. It takes you can have 100 conscious breaths in about roughly 10 minutes, not more or less, in breaths and out breaths. And so, anyway, I just took this into my consciousness. So I'll sit for 10 minutes after I do this, but we won't do that, obviously, today. So let us consider our breaths. Life begins with a deep breath in, and life ends with our final exhalation. Let us examine the space between our out-breath and our next in-breath. Each breath is a decision to continue life and to pursue the eternal. Here we experience a sort of spiritual hang time, like a skier or a skateboarder clearing a jump, or a rider going over the top of a Ferris wheel. We experience le petit mort, the little death, a piece of eternity. Just notice this effect. Don't try to manage or control it. Try a few gentle, conscious breaths of your own. Feel the breath enter your nostrils and travel to your diaphragm. Notice the sacred space this ordinary act creates. Now, I invite you to join me on a cosmic adventure. First, it is vital we avoid capture by the ego. We shall remain very still in the present, where the ego's force field is experienced at its weakest. In the awareness of the present, the ego is deprived of some of its most effective weapons. Fear, anxiety, worry, and doubt. These are all children of the future. The clouds begin to part, and we find ourselves suspended in a loving reality. When we are conscious in the present, there is no lack of love or resources. Now we are going to take 100 breaths together. 100 conscious in-breaths and 100 out-breaths. Take about 10 minutes. These will be no ordinary breaths. These will be our final 100 breaths. Our egos have always whispered that there will be more time. But the goddess Amor shakes her head and turns away. 100 breaths, no more. As we begin these last breaths, we feel the sands of our spirit begin to slip away through the hourglass. What abides? What remains? Amen. So, I encourage you in your own way to try that 100 breaths. It's amazing when we put a finality on time, the alteration in the consciousness. You probably, if you search your experience, you've had your own experiences with this. For example, one of them it's many, many years ago, but I was in a helicopter and came over the PA. He said, "Buckle up, boys, this rag ain't flying no more." And we started in for a hard landing. And there's a suspension of time. And you watch the ground come up, and you look at the trees. You see things differently, and you may have had your own version of something like that, or some situation like that in your own life. And those are kind of life-changing moments. And if I can reach toward those in my meditation, it seems to have a great impact. So. Leslie's going to share a bit with us here.
Yeah, I guess I had talked about, amends and my mom and, her dropping early on, kind of hearing what it was like to have me as a daughter, in essentially two sentences, 25 words or less. It summed it all up. And, I didn't realize, my attitude was, I'm not hurting anybody but myself. Leave me alone. So what if I'm cut up in a ditch someplace? It's my life. I was one of those people, Leslie, you have so much potential, they'd say. And I said, well, it's my potential. Leave me alone. I'll do with it what I want to. And so, it took me a little while after I made amends to my parents. And my father was kind of the same way. He's just, we love you and we're glad you're sober. And he wasn't He's still alive, but he's not. He was never one to grab me up, and he wasn't touchy feely. He's very, very German, and you know, proper. And he always, you know, went to work, and a very, very stoic kind of guy. And I knew he loved me, but I never felt really, I guess, felt it in a way. I'd feel it from my grandparents, you know. And so he was just very, you know, we're just glad you're sober and proud of you. And my mom just was always effusive and constantly gave me messages about how much she loved me. And then, but, you know, when I gave her the window to let her know that it was safe to say anything to me, what she really wanted, she fired one shot, and that's probably not a good description, but she, you know, sent one message through the opening, which I was hoping, you know, it was wide enough, but she just really wanted to deliver one message. And that was, what I heard was, you think only of yourself. And it's not helpful to you or to anybody else. And, you know, and it was all just describing the pain, This is what it's like when the phone rings. Actually, I don't know if I remember telling this story. I don't know if I told it in here, but I asked her if there was anything, how I made her feel. If there's anything she'd like to share with me. And she said, you know, that 10 seconds, it would be at 3 a.m. And, you know, when you get a call at 3 a.m. and you're a parent with a daughter who's, you know, over old enough to drive a car, and I was still living there, I might have been, it was several times, you know, I think I moved out at back and forth. I moved out at 17, but then I was kind of back and forth until I was about 23. And she said it was that 8 or 9 seconds from the time the phone rang at 3 a.m. to the time I picked it up and knew you were okay was sheer hell. Absolutely. And I never thought of that. I just thought, hey, I'm doing my thing. You know, I'm an adult. And it just hit me like a rocket. I thought, I don't have kids, but when she put it in perspective that you just don't know, and I've loved things, people, animals, but to have something that close, you know, as your own daughter and not knowing, like Mike said, I would walk that child I'd take that child to the Canadian border if I loved him so much. And so I got an insight into how I destroy people's lives. And so with my mom, I wanted to make that right. And you know what they say, you know what parents say is that, what can I do to make this right? Well, we just want you to be happy. We just want, just continue what you're doing. And she loved Alcoholics Anonymous. She absolutely loved you. And she never went to a meeting, an open meeting or anything, but she loved the effect. And we, you know, we talk about how my atheist friends and agnostic friends, they don't necessarily say it as God isn't real, but they want something that's more palpable. You know, this there's something out there in the ethers, and I'm going to pray, no, electromagnetic energy. Now I can wrap my head around that. And this whole idea of God, you can't see it, you know. And I remember as a little kid, you know, when I was in grade school, Pluto used to be a planet. And I don't know what its status is now. I think it was not a planet. Now maybe it is. But, you know, when I was a kid, it wasn't a planet. And so there'd be pictures, you know, of all the other planets except Pluto in the books. And they would say, well, we haven't actually seen it. But we know it's there because we can see the effect it has on the other planets, on Uranus. There's a wobble in Uranus's. As it goes around, but we haven't seen it. And these are scientists, you know, and so my atheist friends are all about science, you know. And I think, well, this is faith, really, you know. They know that Pluto's there because they see the effect it has on other bodies. And that's exactly what we do here. I see the effect it has on you. And so I know there's something. I can't see it, but I have faith that it's out there. And my mom was... you know, my mom was like that. She loved the effect that you guys had on me. So how do I go about being a daughter? I didn't know, you know, and I go back to Rita and I don't quite remember the discussion, but it seemed so nebulous. What do I do? And she said, well, you show up as a daughter, you know, you call every week or every, how, and I would call her every week. I'd call her on Sunday, and I didn't know what to say. It was hard. It was, and I love my mom. You know, they were wonderful to me. But it was just, I guess, this unworthiness that I'm just, you know, this daughter that screws everything up. And I didn't know what to say. And she said that because you listen, you don't need to say anything. Just call and talk to them. My mom would tell me these stories about her gardening, and she'd tell me all kinds of things. And I got to understand my mom. And then I started asking her questions about the past. And not, there are questions that would allow her to bring herself, you know, I got to know my mom. You know, not, well, what kind of grandfather was Ed and that kind of thing. I would just let her talk, you know, tell me about what it was like to grow up in Hawaii. She was 7 years old when Pearl Harbor was bombed. And she'd tell me these stories, and she'd tell me what it's like to go to the beach. And she'd, you know, just talk to me and tell me all these wonderful little stories. And it seemed like, and I'd listen and I'd think, gosh, some of these, she's just droning on. And then, you know, I think Rita pointed out, how many times were you droning on when you were, you know, 7 years old? And she just patiently listened to the same story over and over again. And that brought a new perspective, because I'm just, you know, I'm so, I don't even know what I was like at 10 years sober. I think if you were to ask me at 10 years sober, I would have said, oh, yeah, I'm working a pretty good program, you know, I'm doing this. But to actually watch me from afar, that daughter who's like, oh, man, I hear this again. And some of this stuff just breaks my heart terribly. There's a fellow that, he's an American, but he's a Buddhist. And I think now he's not so much a monk, but I know that he works with people at the end stages of life. So he works with death row inmates, and I think he's a psychologist, death row inmates and people that are in hospice. Stephen Levine is his name, and he wrote this wonderful poem, and it's about meditation and how he's meditating. And he's just monkey mind. He's just everywhere. And I'm thinking about the boss. And I'm thinking about this. And the stanza is, it breaks my heart to watch my mind. You know, it just breaks my heart to sit here and watch my mind. And he goes on about more things. And it breaks my heart to watch my mind. And then he starts to have some insight into how he is just broken and how he is just bringing his life here. And just, you know, just gently, just be gentle and look at the pieces. And look at the pieces. And then his final stanza is after that, it breaks my mind to watch my heart. And that's what started to happen with my mom. You know, I just, I was just there with her, just being the daughter that I could be. And then it was 3 years ago, almost 3 years ago, she had a stroke. My father called me, and so I go to the hospital, and she'd had a stroke, and she couldn't, she could tell who I was. She couldn't really move one of her arms, and her face was a little distorted, and she couldn't talk, but she could get up. She wanted to get out. She knew she wanted to get out of the bed and go home, and she could say home, and they couldn't keep her in the bed, and I came, and you know, my mom, I remember my mom was so, she wore the pants in the family. I mean, she was the one she wanted the driveway paved. We had this. We moved into a house, and my father didn't. There was just gravel in the driveway. My mom wanted, she wanted a paved driveway, and he wouldn't have any. There's no reason to spend all that money, and they would. And she was just very gentle. She said, "Don, I really want it." And my father was just determined that we were not going to spend money on this. And one day I got off the school bus, and there were men with rakes and shovels, and they were paving the driveway. And she was just so strong. You know, I watched her through my grandmother's death, and she was cool and spiritual. You know, I grew up Catholic, and she was all about being Catholic. But she said, you know, truth is everywhere. You'll know it when you hear it. And she said, it is, you need to ask questions. I want you to ask questions. And she would read Buddhist books. She'd read all kinds of stuff. She read the whole gamut. Truth is everywhere. She was my, you know, my first spiritual mentor. And so there she is in bed, and now it's time for me to show up. And we, you know, we get her through rehab, and I think she has another stroke. They think she has another stroke. And now it's just going down, and in 6 months she was hospice at home, and I'm helping my father. And he's a mess. I mean, this was his life, his center, and he just can't, he can't work through his grief, really. He's just sort of stuck and vapor locked. And so there I am with my mom, and cleaning her, and just petting on her, and she can't, and I don't even know if she can tell. Every once in a while I get this glimmer that, oh, there you are. But a lot of times I think she's just gone. So I didn't really have a chance to say goodbye in a certain sense. But man, I was so grateful that I called on Sundays and I went over there and I listened to the stories. I got to be with my mom. You know, I got to make that amend. Because there were some people that died before I got there. And that's what this is all about. You know, I just wanted to come into recovery and get my sobriety and go. And not really have to deal with you. You know, I mean, you're a hassle. No matter where you are, at work, on the freeway, in my family, you're just really a hassle. I just really want some smooth sailing and a nice, wide, broad highway. Really just me and God. You know, I don't want to have to deal with you. And it turns out it's not like that. It turns out that God is in you. That's how I access this inner beauty and this infinite breath, this in and out, is right here with you. And I didn't know that until I had to show up. And you know, I'll tell you, my language is puny compared to my experience. I can't describe what happened. I don't have the words. So it's like we have to tell stories. We have to paint pictures. It's kind of like this. If you can sort of use your own imagination on your own experience and walk through this path and see, you know, I have this map from this gal and this map from this guy of this path. And let me see, do any of the signposts look like this? And you know, by giving, so I say giving pieces of myself away is just an inadequate way to describe it. But, you know, when I just give myself away, like Mother Teresa describes it. She had a nun ask her, you know, they come, sister, they come and they just take and they want everything and they need all this attention. And I just give myself away, when do you stop? When do I start to? And she said, no, you give yourself away until you're completely gone. Until you're completely gone. And I don't want to do that. You know, it's like the big sponge of God coming down. No. But, you know, that's exactly how, why do I want to fight being absorbed, you know, into you, not up there? Because I think God is up there, but God is right here, just right here. And why do I not want to give myself away and just flow into everything and have all of you? I have all of this instead of just trying to contain it into this container. And so that was a wonderful lesson. Then my mom died. You know, and this was terrible. I watched her. I work in the medical field. But she essentially starved to death. You know, hospice was, it's just palliative care. We're just going to keep you, just kind of keep you as comfortable as we can with some morphine. And she just sort of stopped eating. And I said, oh, she's not going to eat. Should we put her in? No, that's just kind of how it happens. We drift off. And I almost wanted to, God, can we put her on an ice floe and, like, send her off and she'll die faster and more peace. And so I watched it. Anyway, I was there to take care of my dad, really, is the reason I was there, because he was just a mess watching her just degenerate and end up in this little, you know, I don't know, 78-pound little bag of bones. But I'm so glad I was there for it. It was a spiritual experience beyond anything I ever would have asked for. So what questions do we have for Mike or me, or just comments about this whole process so far?
What is an ice floe?
Oh, an ice floe is a little chunk of an iceberg, and I guess Eskimos used it. I might be making this up. You'll have to Google it, because that's where you'll find the truth. But it seems like what they would do is put their old people, you know, so instead of hospice, I mean, the Eskimos would take care of them as long as they could, I suppose. But then when it's time, you put them on the ice floe, and then they go out and they freeze to death, and it's, you know, happens.
That's what I awful. Thought it was. But I thought it was a medical term for, like...
Oh, know, gotcha, yeah.
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 That's what I figured you'd do.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Nice, sounds sweet.
Yeah. Anybody else with any comments or questions about steps 1 through 9?
I've got a question.
Yeah.
At think there might be, there's always some confusion around the concept of living amends. And so I thought you guys could maybe touch on your ideas and your experiences around that concept.
Boy, do I have an opinion. And it's much gentler than it used to be. The way I put it with the guys I work with is that it's very important that I live out my amends. The fact is that if I can go and we can have this magic moment together and everything else, but if my behavior and my interactions with you are not changed, nothing has really happened. As you know, it's what Leslie's talking about. See, I first of all, there's no, a gift isn't a gift until it's presented and accepted. And so part of that whole process, I can buy a house, but if I don't make the mortgage payments, whatever, have I really bought a house? It's what I did. I had to make amends for some people because in previous times I did things that gave AA, I'm not that important, but I gave AA a bad name, I'm sure, with some people. I can remember one guy at the phone company back in the day I negotiated with, and he gave me all these breaks, and I blew him off. I made a couple of payments, and then that was it, And, of course, years later, that's one reason I'm going to talk to you a bit before you make your amends, whether you go in there and I'm an AA and, all that kind of stuff, really. So especially if I identify myself as a member of AA, and so I had one interesting reaction that I'm still dealing with. Guy I worked with went in to make amends, and he did as typical, and why are you doing this? Well, I'm doing this because I never want to drink again. Oh, so if you weren't worried about drinking again, I could just go screw myself. That's what you're telling me? So I'm still doing the selfish, self-centered act. The only reason I'm doing the right thing with you is so I can get something I think I need right now. Now, that in fact may be the case, but I don't know that I'm doing you any favor by putting that in your face that way. That's why I spend some time and care and prep time with folks before they make those approaches on the amends, and they're different. One of the things with my mother is I had to be careful with my mother not to describe myself as an alcoholic. Not because I was in any doubt about that, but when my mother heard the word alcoholic, she heard bad mother. And I tried to be, therapists had tried, all the world had tried to explain it to her, medical people, everybody kind of, and she wasn't a stupid woman, but there was a block there. Somehow, if she just had loved me right or loved me a little bit more, and that's what I'd used to manipulate her. So for her benefit, part of that was, I would say, well, that I'm with these recovery people, and oh, it's so nice you helped them, and blah blah blah, and not knowing that. But you see, we try and be sensitive to others. I don't need to push my agenda with you when we're making amends. That's me just continuing the harm in a little softer, fuzzier way. My experience, but I got a I got to live out the amends, and that's one of the reasons I follow up. Okay, how are those payments going? Are you talking to your mother, your father? What are you doing here? Are you spending time with your kids? What's that dialogue look like when you're together? Are you taking the kid that can't stand fishing, and claiming you're spending time with them, but you're really dragging them along to do what you want to do? You know, we got to look at these things. So anyway.
Yeah. No, I agree. I don't have anything to add to that. You want to?
Wait, one thing real quick. So, the living out of the amends after we've made the approach and gone through the conversation and become clear on how to make things right if it's possible, and living them out sounds like practicing the principles and those affairs to a great degree. So a recent example I had was a guy came to me, which is I've heard several times over the years, that he was told that he didn't need to make amends to his ex-girlfriends. He just needed to treat his future girlfriends really well, and he would perform a living amends that way for his ex-girlfriends, which I personally think is not the right way to do it, because I think some of the best amends are the ones with the ex-spouses. And so that's the concept of living amends that this was within the past couple of months where I had this conversation. And I'm assuming you may have run across this in your time, where people try to get out of making amends by saying, oh, that's a living amends, I don't need to make that one.
Yeah. Well, okay, well, take me to the page in here about living amends. You know, I may have missed it, you know, in that regard. You know, it's, you know, I'm not, one of the changes with me is that I'm no longer part of the SWAT team. I'm not going to get up. See, I am so sick that I will use spiritual principles as an excuse to spray my ego all over you, that I'm the guy who knows, and you know, me trying to, cause, you know, I suppose, you know, if I went to one of your ex-wife or your girlfriend, would she say, oh, I feel so much better that Tarek is making living amends and he's treating his new girlfriend. I mean, what, do you think we'd get an answer like that? You know? And so, it's one of those things that I'm sure sounds good. That's my problem with most slogans, is they tend to be, there's always a kernel of truth, but it's usually wrapped in some BS, you know, and it sounds nice and good and fuzzy, but you know, let's break it down. That's one of the things Don was so very good at me. With me in doing, because I'd say something and he's, well, let's talk about that, which is, if you knew him, did not mean we were going to talk about it. He was going to talk and I was going to listen. So, that's the deal on the person that has been amended should know they've been amended, you know. Maybe in the next world you'll wake up with a, you know, honey, those hot flashes are really my psychic amends coming to you across the years.
And I think some of that stuff kind of bubbles up too, you know. I don't know if you know, sometimes I'll talk with someone who's it's clear that she kind of wants to get back with him. And then there are the ones that, oh, yeah, no, I don't want to. What she seems to be doing is a little image management. You know, I want that bad girl image. I don't want to look like I'm, you know, all of a sudden becoming some sort of religious nut, you know. But it you know, as you look at it, and I think some of these things maybe you just kind of throw out there and just it's something like a group conscience. It kind of, something sort of bubbles up. And then it's a matter of the words. What do you say, you know, to get to the place where they feel like they've been amended. like you've actually addressed something. Maybe that takes time. Yeah. Go.
Last night there was a question posed outside of this gym, right? How do you listen to a footstep? And this has been great for me. I'm like a mechanic. My sponsor tells me all the time, you're a mechanic of the book. You understand it all.
Yeah.
But it's been good to hear the heart side of it, right? Because sometimes I get too caught in the mechanics. But how do you listen to a fifth step, and what are you looking for in a fifth step to handle the sponsor?
Oh, gosh. Well, if it's their very first fifth step, then I start with resentment inventory, and I think I said last night I just have them write down who they're mad at and why, essentially, and pretty close to, you know, maybe a session or two before, you know, I read the book with them. You know, we read each word and back and forth and talk about it, and then just before we finish, we agnostics, I just have them write down a couple of, you know, write down as much as you can, just those two columns. And then we sort of do a couple of them, the last two columns, you know, what it affects and my mistakes with them, and just sort of explore. They throw it out there, and I tell them, if you can, I mean, write down what you think it affects and what you think your mistake is. And then we just sort of talk about it. And it seems like what I do is sort of help move them around, like I put them on the dolly and sort of move them around the piece of art and just let them have different perspectives and ask questions. It's kind of, man, for some, I'm kind of a mechanic too, but there, I think there's some, you know, art involved in it. And as my first sponsee, I had it like a year sober, so it's been 22 years. So what I started out doing, what I do now, are really different. I pick things up in places like this. But I think really what I listen, I just, something will flash for me, and it'll be, you know, an aspect of pride or just something that comes up, and then I'll ask them, what do you think? This is kind of what I'm seeing. And I think as a sponsor, your best function is to get them to ask themselves the right questions. And that's kind of hard to do, but you know, I mean, really what I am is I'm a tool. So I say, God, help me out here. And I come in and it seems like words come out my mouth that were never in my head. They just bypassed the head and came out the heart, out my mouth. But just sort of get them to see a different perspective, and then that pretty much rolls into a fear inventory right quick. And then conduct, that's a mechanical answer.
You know, well, Les just reminded me of something that was so great moment with Don, as he looked at me and he said, you know, Mike, he says, answers aren't your problem. He says, it's getting you to the right question. And he says, the answer is already there in your heart, you know. Would you like to terrify some children today? Well, hell no. See, I don't even see the question, though. Would you like to, you know, would you like to break your mother's heart? Well, no. And I know the answers. I pretend that I don't. Well, I don't know why. I keep. Yes, I do. I know. I don't want to know. I don't. My problem is all the information is here. I don't want to know it. And it's getting me to the point where I realize sort of what we were talking about with the men's, you know, trying to figure out what the easier, softer way on a men's might be here. It's my current sponsor is Bob Bazans, and one of the things that Bob says, besides telling me I'm an idiot, well, I say, you know, Bob, I just told Jess, he said, you're an idiot. Yeah. Yeah, we're not even going to discuss that. But no, Bob says, you know, I got this notion that I can pee in one side of the glass and drink out of the other. You know, and think about it, that's just kind of a cute way of saying that I create the world I live in. You know, when I'm living as straight up as I can with the world, I tend to see the world reflected back to me that way. And when I'm trying to shoot the angle and get an edge and, you know, stick a shiv in here and there, and you know, it's for your own good. I'm just going to teach you a little lesson, you know, and a little tough love, and all that kind of stuff. See, that's now I've just created the world I'm living in. And so one of the reasons it's so important for me to look at what I'm doing and how I'm doing it, because that's the soup that I'm going to be swimming in. And I'm the guy that's making it. I believe it. I believe it's coming at me from out there when it's coming out of me. My delusion is that I exist as this separate entity, and you all you gray shapes out there are kind of stage figures in my drama. And that's not true. That's not true. You're all a part of me. I'm a part of you. I'm a part of the whole thing. And so if I treat you badly, we used to, when I came around in the 80s, there was a lot of talk about self-esteem, and we spent a lot of time trying to self-esteem ourselves. And I'd put post-it notes on the bathroom mirror, "Mike, you're a great guy. Mike, you're a rib," you know, and eventually it'd peel and fall off. And I, you know, Mike, you're full of shit, you know. I knew better. See, what I wanted to do is I wanted a trick. I wanted a shortcut. And it's, you know, the people that love me and, you know, it's like kids. Kids got to, we all got going to have to try something. People I sponsor, I've got to understand that I had to be 2 years sober and chasing the married gal, and I had to be 5 years sober and not showing up in the marriage, and I had to be these other things in order to do it. I don't just, it's not a matter that I just didn't have the information. The information was always there. I just wasn't convinced that I needed to put it on the street and live it that way, or that I could, for that matter. So, I don't know. I'm just rattling here. But yeah, get to the question.
We got
one more. Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
I'm trying to make this brief. Okay. Yesterday you start sharing about dementia. Okay, yeah. With some of your family. Yeah. And I don't cry. Last time I cried was about my puppies. I just, well, you know, out of a place just loving them so much. Well, I spent the rest of the day yesterday biting my mouth because I was like crying all the time in this meeting and trying not to have tears run down my face because of basically my dad's got late stage dementia. And I have so many amends to make to him because he's my stepdad and he's spectacular. Okay, he's not a good guy, he's a spectacular guy in a lot of ways with me. And what you shared about Leslie, about spending time with your mom and showing up, okay, there are a couple things. One is, I know I'm doing this because I want to do the right thing and have freedom, okay? But just as important to me is I want to try to make amends to him for all the shit that I put him through in his life. And it's like... spend time with, I could go move in over there, literally, and spend 24 hours a day with him, you know? I mean, that's who I feel right now in my heart. I owe this guy so much, and I want his last year to be good, you know, as far as getting feelings from your vibes. It's like, where do you draw that line in the sand saying, hey, I'm doing the best I can with amends with this. I really want to feel like he gets the... impact of how much I love him and all this type of stuff. But, you know, I guess it's a kind of a pragmatic question about time, allocation of time, you know, whatever. So what's your feeling about that as far as just like spending time with him and how much is enough? Or, and I know obviously it's how much is enough for me, but you know, I don't know if I'm explaining this correctly, but.
Yeah, I think so. And I'm not, I don't know. I think it's those forks in the road, the place you come and you do what you do. You know, I pick one out of several options, or I just try to follow my heart and just sort of just listen to that voice of God. And I don't know. I'm sorry. It's hard to answer because I've been to those places and I'm just like you. I mean, what should I do here? And I don't think it's information so much as I just have to let my heart lead me. It's not an intellectual question. It's just do something and see how it feels and adjust. You know, like sailing. You just have to trim your sails and by the wind and where you think you want to go, if that's my goal. And then the goal changes sometimes and you get more information or you know, things change. I don't know, Mike, what do you
think? Yeah, good answer. See, this is really where that spiritual relationship happens. And one of the good tests that Don gave me about, you know, I not in this area particularly, but you know, when I was trying to make this, should I do this or shouldn't I do that? He said, well, try asking yourself this question. He says, if I go do this, can I take God with me? And that'll. And so, assuming that I've done that and I'm now doing this, that you know, okay, if I had God with me, what, you know, what should I be doing here? And I'm not always going to do it right. It's like she says, it's like tacking back and forth. But my fear is always. Always that I'm going to somehow do too much for you, you know, and I've rarely ever regretted loving too much, or you know, or something like that. And when I've done it too much, turns out it wasn't love. I was doing it because I wanted somebody else to see me doing it and think that I was a great guy or one thing and another. And you know, it'll, you know, when we're heart to heart with in a situation like that, my case, my mother was 375 miles down the interstate from me, and so I could not be there as much as I wanted to. The suggestion that was made to me was that when I those times, first of all, to support the other siblings that were more on the firing line than I was, and second of all, to make sure that when I was there, I was really there. That I wasn't sitting by mom with my laptop open, you know, working on something else and reach over and pat her every now and then, you know. Now, I mean, there can be that time, but I'd sit and, you know, bring a VCR of Lawrence Welk for her, you know, and let her, because she'd go back to the time machine or something like that. And I had no interest in that, but see, the act of love is that I'm going to sit there and hold her hand and pat her hand and be with her in that kind of an experience. And I never walked away from one of those while I, you know, it was hard to stay awake through some of them. I never walked away feeling like I'd wasted my time. Because of every now and then, like Leslie says, every now and then I bet you've experienced, even as the grip of the disease tightens, there are just those flash moments. By the way, my mother taught me something great about resentment in that she's in this dementia world, and everything else in all of us. And she, you know, as I was telling you yesterday, she's this gentle little gal. Everybody loved her. And all of a sudden, I just watched her eyes crossed, and it was like the devil was inside her. And she says, "That goddamn Sal broke my doll." And it turned out 75 years before, her older sister had broken the head on this China doll of hers. And I could see across 75 years, it was alive like she wanted to choke her right now in the present. So if we don't think these things live in us, we're nuts. Because I know I've seen the evidence, and I'd never heard that, you know, over years and years. But I would have missed that if I hadn't been spending time with her when I could, and showing up for it. So that'll be a great walk, and it's a great sadness. But if we take these things, the great sadness will turn out to be a great joy and a great lesson as well. Is my experience with it.